Can I approach?
Certainly.
Thank you.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Reed Yurchak. I am counsel for Mr. Phillips in this matter, the appellant. This comes on for review of a trial court's decision in a parented action between two unmarried parents, Mr. Phillips, the father, and Mrs. Atchison, the mother.
How much time would you like to reserve?
I wasn't going to ask.
You weren't going to ask, so you're going to use all your time?
Yes.
Okay. Excuse me. Thank you.
To a now three-year-old child, the trial court entered findings with respect to a parenting plan and child support order, which contain some unique factors, which some of which seem to be an issue of first impression for this court.
What are those? Why don't we take them separately? Which one do you want to address first?
I'm going to start with the child support issues first.
Okay. So what are the issues of first impression related to the child support order?
The primary issue of first impression is with respect to the court finding with respect to the court's findings with daycare. So there are very few cases which interpret the statutory requirement that the court exercise discretion to find that daycare expenses are reasonable and necessary. The statute in question is RCW 2619-080, which states that the court may exercise its discretion to determine the necessity and the reasonableness for all amounts ordered in excess of the basic support obligation.
So you concede that the standard of review is abuse of discretion?
Yes.
So how or why did the court abuse its discretion in allocating the daycare expenses?
So the court appeared to consider none of the factors, none of the facts with respect to why daycare would be reasonable and necessary for the circumstances in this case.
Well, there was a four-day trial.
It was a four-day trial.
And there was testimony.
That's right.
And so the court was entitled to rely on the testimony at trial related to the need to allocate daycare expenses.
I think, Your Honor, the issue goes to the fact that the child support laws did not choose to incorporate daycare as something that should be included in the basic support obligation. Daycare is a separate expense, a special expense, that the court must exercise discretion in determining whether to impose it or not.
But the court was entitled to rely on the testimony at trial, correct?
I'm not disputing that the court wasn't allowed to rely on the testimony at trial. I'm disputing that the court there was not substantial evidence to support the court's findings that daycare in this instance was reasonable and necessary. And
the trial court, I thought, gave weight to the fact that the mother was disabled in terms of the need for daycare. How would you address that factor?
Well, I would address that factor by saying that the court, that if you read the facts, if you read the trial transcript, the mother never testified that she needed daycare because of her disability. Her disability was related to anxiety, and my recollection of her testimony in my review prior to today was that her disability prevented her simply from working, that she had difficulty computing numbers. She was a financial manager, and because of that disability, she could no longer work. There was no testimony that she couldn't provide care for her child. Otherwise, that trial would be completely different. It would be more about custody aspects than it would be about, child support issues.
Well, wasn't there testimony that because of the medical appointments that she did have a daycare?
I think, Your Honor, what I would represent is that in any circumstance where you have a single parent or even a two-parent family where both parents are working, every family has occasion where they're going to need, quote-unquote, daycare, a babysitter. You want to go to the movies. You
well,
have an appointment
it,
to was, get your nails
done. Was it regular?
So in this circumstance, we have a parent who is using regular daycare. She testified that she is paying $1,080 a month for daycare, a regular daycare at 18 hours a week. At $15 an hour, she said she was paying. And if you do the math, for some reason, it doesn't add up to $1,080. But when you look at the overall circumstances in which this daycare, the need for that daycare is arising, we have a parent who's testified that she's unemployed and has no intent to seek employment. We have a parent who testified that she has no work-related reasons to be outside of her home. There was no testimony with respect to what kinds of things she's doing outside of the home that would necessitate having regular daycare. There was simply no testimony of any nature of that kind. So we have a 40-year-old woman who went through business school, who worked on the trading floor in New York, worked in Seattle, earned substantial money, became pregnant, claimed a disability since 2010, and has decided voluntarily to stay at home and be a single mother.
But you haven't assigned error to any of those factual findings, have you?
We assigned error to the fact that the court did not exercise proper discretion in finding that those daycare expenses were not reasonable enough.
I get the daycare, but what about the fact you're sort of alluding to her employability, I guess, for lack of a better term? You didn't assign error to that, as I understand it.
No, those are simply the facts.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to assign error to someone's testimony. Those are simply the facts. And so there's one case, the Mattson case, which discussed the reasonableness and the necessity of daycare expenses. It noted that there was no definition, statutory definition, for that, and so it simply defined it in the term, in the context of the framework of what the best interest of the child standard is, sort of that nebulous standard. So when you look at the facts of Mattson, we have summer camp costs, which the mother wanted to be reimbursed for as daycare. So the court looked at that in terms of whether that's reasonable and necessary. And it looked at the fact, and the factors that it looked at was, number one, that the mother was working. Number two, she was a custodial parent. She was responsible for supervising the children. Number three, those camp costs were something that fit within what could be expected as far as the standard of living that those children enjoyed, and thus it fit with that and was thus reasonable. The court has to draw a line somewhere, because again, the child support statutes do not include daycare as a part of a standard support obligation. I recognize that a parent at any point may have some errand to run or some free time they'd like to have for themselves where they incur some sort of babysitting expense, but the court has clearly said that there is a delineation between that circumstance and regular daycare expenses. And in this instance, the mother need for daycare simply doesn't seem apparent from the testimony that she gave. The other problem with the daycare expenses is the other assignment of error, that there was no testimony that she actually incurred these expenses under the statute. 2619.080 requires that for daycare expenses to be reimbursable, it must show that they were actually incurred.
After they're ordered?
I don't see that there's any distinction in that regard, Your Honor. I don't see any distinction between, because factually speaking, those expenses under the Fairchild case.
So the court did not order your client to reimburse for daycare expenses. This is prospective going forward, and I think there is an issue about whether they're actually incurred, but that's later.
I think that's an impermissible shifting of the burden onto my client. You're saying that, essentially I think what Your Honor is saying is that a parent could come to court and give a statement. I have $2,000 a month daycare expenses.
Well,
and that's supposed to be upheld without any sort of proof whatsoever. That shifts the burden onto my client to later have to bring further litigation and a motion to the court for reimbursement to then prove that those aren't permissible expenses.
Well, I think once again we're back to the testimony at trial. Either the court could believe it or not believe it.
I think what we're looking at the statute here in terms of whether the standard of proof that Fairchild ordered, that the parent must show that these expenses were actually incurred, whether that is something that only arises in the context of a reimbursement action, or if that's something that comes up in the context
What were the facts in Fairchild?
Fairchild.
Wasn't that a reimbursement?
Fairchild was a reimbursement. But I don't think that's, I think we're mixing up what the holding in Fairchild is. Fairchild simply established what the standard of proof should be, and for the trial court to find that daycare expenses were actually incurred. What is the definition of actually incurred in that statute? It means that it has to be more than simply a self-serving statement. It has to be more than a declaration. In Fairchild, the mother simply submitted a written declaration that said this is what it is. The court said that's not enough. It said we need some sort of actual proof. Canceled checks, contracts. In this case, the daycare provider, I don't think, was even ever identified.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. David Zuckerman representing Ms. Atchison. I think I should maybe should just briefly note that there was substantial evidence to support the trial court's ruling regarding daycare expenses. Ms. Atchison was disabled. It didn't appear that she had any relatives living nearby who could help her with spell her as far as the child care. And the court had awarded her virtually all of the residential time, at least during phase one. The only time that she really had any problem with parenting was during a time when she didn't know what to do with the child because she was trying to get some errand run and she left the child inappropriately with someone she shouldn't have. So there was certainly ample evidence in the record for the court's ruling. And I think the court has already pointed out the distinction between Fairchild, which I think is an apt one. After all, very often, a party won't even attempt to start looking for a daycare provider until she knows that the court has agreed that this will be a reasonable and necessary expense that will be shared. I guess I should perhaps turn to some other issues that haven't been brought up. As far as the imputed income, the court went to the portion of the statute, the only ones that could have applied here, because there was ample evidence that Mr. Phillips's income was unknown, and the judge made that finding.
Well, he argues that the court erred because there were two other priorities that the court did not properly consider. Can you address those two other priorities?
Yes, Your Honor.
And why the court skipped to the last priority related to unknown?
Yes.
And I think actually, they actually then throw in three later. I mean, there's also the I've been released from prison exception. But there are two others that are priorities, if you could address.
Yes. Well, and let me just start by saying this is all based on the judge's finding that there was no reliability to what Mr. Phillips was claiming because his bank accounts showed huge deposits, tens of thousands of dollars from various people, all of which he was claiming were gifts.
So were the bank accounts part of the evidence at trial?
Yes.
And when the court made this finding as to reliability, was that part of the court's oral ruling?
The court ruled somewhat tersely that his income was unknown.
Right.
And that was...
I didn't see reliability, so that's why I'm asking where you're getting...
Well, but, he was claiming he had no income. The court disagreed with that and said
right.
It was unknown. And the reason she said it was unknown was because he was claiming that these enormous amounts of money coming into his account
were all gifts,
including right. One of the gifts was from a person who had just recently employed him for his high-tech work. And this is a guy who is incredibly skilled in software and hardware and very valuable to an employer.
Well, so then his argument was, I have this past history. So if you could address those other two
sure.
priorities.
Well, I can just go down the list of orders of priority. Full-time earnings at current rate of pay. Well, he's claiming no current rate of pay.
Well, so. I think he was claiming that he had been paid $2,500 a month.
In the past, but that wouldn't be a current.
No, and that, I guess that's the next priority.
So then we go to full-time earnings at a historical rate based on reliable information. And the court clearly did not think there was reliable information.
Well, was there any dispute that he got $2,500 a month while he was in federal work release?
During that very specific time period, that was the only time that there was any that he submitted any clear evidence as to.
So he's arguing that's reliable, that's clear evidence. Why did the court not take that into consideration in relationship to that person?
But it's not reliable if, in fact, he's been making. He's very possibly been making substantially more money than that.
Well, not while he was in prison.
Right, not while he's in prison. But I don't see where there is any requirement here that the court go back to just that particular specific time period as opposed to other time periods.
So historic
after
would
all,
be...
he's out of prison now.
So historic would be before prison to the present.
Certainly the court would have discretion to look at that when this is a person who was lavishly compensated for his high-tech skills prior to going into prison.
Well, you would have to have a job to be in work release, and the court presumably could consider that. Wasn't he in work release at the time of the trial? Or had he just completed?
I'm not sure of that, but certainly you're correct that he was required to have a job during work release and therefore had no choice but to show a certain amount of income during that time period.
And the deposits of the sums of money, were those, when were those made? Were they contemporaneous with the trial?
I believe so. I mean, they were, during the time periods after he got out of prison, and I think going right up until the time of trial or very close to it. So what the court was then stuck with, actually she could have used C, which would have been much more unfavorable to Mr. Phillips, which would be full-time earnings at a past rate where information is incomplete or sporadic. The information here was incomplete or sporadic, right. And she could have gone back to the big bucks he was earning before he went to prison.
Right.
She did not. She gave him a break. She could not give him full-time earnings at minimum wage because he never had a history of minimum wage work. So what she finally went to was the last one, which was more favorable to him, which was simply medium net income, even though this guy had a history of earning far, far more than that. Unless there are any questions on that, I would move to the issue of whether the parenting plan is even before the court.
Well, how are you prejudiced if we consider the argument that's been made?
Well, I guess I'm not if the court is inclined to find that the trial court was within its discretion to make the rulings that it did. And I think that's pretty clear from the briefing.
I think the challenge there is the imposition of the restrictions under 191.
Correct. And in this case, to the extent that I understand the arguments being made, one of them is that, well, because the parenting evaluator said there was domestic violence, but then the judge didn't use that particular restriction, that somehow that meant that all of the parenting evaluator's recommendations must be faulty.
Right. Well, it seems to be some sort of argument that it's a de facto domestic violence restriction under 191 without making findings to support it. But aren't there other bases that the court relied upon in imposing the 191 restriction here?
Absolutely.
In fact, I think the appellant said he had a drug dependency issue, and that's why he sought out a shorter prison sentence.
Right. Drug dependency was one of the big factors.
Well, but the court specifically found it was willful abandonment.
Correct.
That, I mean, the court didn't rely on the drug dependency.
Willful abandonment and the
neglect.
And the neglect.
Isn't that the basis for the well, those are the two factors that are the basis
exactly.
for the restriction.
I think the court didn't find that the DV, as defined in the statute, that DV wasn't quite the right fit.
Well, we don't know because we know what the court did, but we don't have a lot about what the court considered and rejected.
Right.
We can assume that.
And
so willful abandonment and neglect, was there evidence to support imposing restrictions for those two factors, and if so, what?
Absolutely. And it's in my brief at pages 16 through 18.
All right.
And it shows that even when he had a chance, he did not take advantage of it in parenting the child.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Next case is